ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
I don't know if you're a vegetarian or not, but if you have a chicken burger for lunch,
yeah.
The chicken patty takes a cup of diesel through the supply chain to get that chicken patty on your burger. And if you have a beef burger, it's 2 cups of diesel.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis, joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Claire Armstrong in the chair for Frank Kelly today. I will do my best, joining you from Ngunnawal country here in Parliament House, Canberra.
Your best is always good, so we're going to do well, Claire. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. This special
Question Time episode is actually an extra special Question Time episode because thanks to the federal budget still dominating headlines this week, and not all of them great for the government as it tries to sell its proposals, many of you have questions you'd like us to tackle specifically on the budget, nitty gritty, and the big budget sell. So we'll do that today. But before we get there, Claire, a bit of other news we need to unpack that's around this morning. We have been aware that they were going to come for about a week or so, but late last night, the ABC had some vision of the ISIS-linked Australian women and children leaving the Al-Roj camp in northeastern Syria. The ABC has seen the bus carrying the group, which left the camp on Thursday afternoon local time. And there's already been questions to the government this morning, because this is, like, just to be clear, the second cohort of women and children coming back, which means, you know, it's on. The government has to deal with the fallout of that, right?
Yeah, it's the second in this latest iteration. There have been cohorts that have returned previously under the Albanese government and even under the Morrison government before that. What's complicating is that essentially the group that were brought back earlier, either assisted or otherwise, were, I guess you could say, lower risk, were deemed by various security agencies to be less of an issue in terms of potential charges or other things that might be levelled against them upon their return. So that is kind of why it's escalated as each cohort has come back. It's sort of been a more complex group each time. That is particularly, I think, the case for this last group, maybe second last group. I'm not entirely sure of the size of this one that's coming, but it does put a lot of pressure on the government, although they do have the example they can point to of just a few weeks ago where a lot of charges were laid against some of the women that returned from Syria. So there's a kind of established pathway here of not just rhetoric from the government saying they'll be dealt with the full force of the law, which is what I think Tanya Plibersek and others have said this morning, but there's obviously now a kind of proof point for that in how the previous group were treated. That's what I think the government will be relying on to kind of smooth this political path for them that we know the opposition are going to make a big deal out of.
Yeah, that's right. The other thing that's happened, Claire, which I think is worth noting, is the treatment and now reaction to the Australian activists who were aboard the flotilla to Gaza and were detained by Israel. Now, you know, if you haven't seen that vision, it's pretty alarming. It's Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is a very far-right politician in Netanyahu's coalition that he's cobbled together. He's a guy that is known to be an extremist, posted a very alarming video of some pretty inhumane treatment of these protesters, including, of course, Australians are in that cohort. Our government has condemned it, but it's become a bit of a political headache, I think, for, again, public relations, political headache for Israel, because Australia, that already has a strained relationship, and other nations are sort of condemning this. Benjamin Netanyahu did condemn Ben-Gvir, but he's still in his front bench, so it's kind of all very weird as far as I can see. It's like, I condemn him, but he's still here. Social Services Minister Tanya Plibersek says 11 Australian activists who were aboard that flotilla to Gaza were detained by Israel. They're now in Turkey. So, you know, they're obviously on the pathway to coming home. The father of Australian Niamh O'Connor, who was one of the activists captured, has also spoken overnight. You know, there are lots of sort of outrage, if you like, from this cohort, and rightly so. This is pretty revolting coming from a liberal democracy. You don't expect this, and yet it happened, and we see it on the images. But it really, again, has been a flashpoint, I see, in the relationship where our government, you know, using words of condemnation again, and it's just kind of a festering sore, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. There's been, you know, almost total unity from the government in its response to this, which in and of itself, I think, suggests that this issue is perhaps far more clear-cut than the way that the government's found itself tying itself in knots on some of the other issues around when there are calls to condemn certain actions by Israel or otherwise. We had the Executive Council of Australian Jewry even condemn in a statement Ben Gavir that the images that have come out, you know, even just of the way that the people on this flotilla were detained, you know, the wire-tied wrists behind their back bent over on the ground, and then obviously the taunting by a senior member of the Israeli government. It's very confronting, and I think that it will put a strain, you know, 11 Australians in that group, it will put a strain, further strain, on relations between the two countries.
I actually had the Assistant Foreign Minister, Matt Thistlethwaite, on Afternoon Briefing on TV, and I said to him, isn't this the lowest point of the Israel-Australia relationship? And we've had, obviously, a series of these flashpoints. And he said, you know, he kind of tried to avoid, you know, we've got talked about Australia supporting the you know, original project of Israel, but only in a two-state solution, really leaning into that. It just, again, the messaging from the government is consistently pointing out the things that Israel's not doing, I found. You know, like they're not really supporting a two-state solution, are they? But we are officially now. So you can just see, I think, the gap between us as nations grow and grow. One to watch, but obviously very, very uncomfortable viewing that those images. If you saw the video, no doubt you had a strong reaction like we all did. Shall we head into federal budget special of Question Time, Claire?
Please.
We shall move to questions without notice. Are there any questions? I give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Yeah.
Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. That means it's time for Question Time. This week, our first question comes from Alex.
My question's around the budget. Is it possible that the Treasurer deliberately went big with this budget, you know, so reformist, just to test what the markets and voters would actually accept, knowing, of course, that he could dial it back and will dial it back when it actually goes to legislation? So essentially, is he using this as a political temperature check rather than a genuine policy blueprint? Love the show. Thanks so much.
Alex, this is a good question. So you are suggesting, I like it, I like a theory, and then like let's pull it apart, or at least, you know, talk about which bits might be right and wrong. Did he go bigger so then he could go smaller? I like that idea, like bigger to go smaller. Well, as I see it, governments always put forward things that they know might change through the passage of the parliament, because that's like democracy, right? Like that's how it works. And so, yes, he's aware, as he put this forward, that they would have to negotiate on key elements, so much so that there's even a line in the budget about the startups. I mean, they put that in. Now, I know they're privately frustrated because it's like in there that they realise there's more work to do on the startups when it comes to capital gains tax changes. So they knew it, they put it in there, but as it is in a democracy as well, that's not quite good enough for people, right? Like they're like, yeah, but what's your answer, mate? And that they haven't been able to give us yet. So I personally don't think he was going bigger to then go smaller. I don't, although I do think he knew things would have to change in his ideal world, not too much. But let's see if his ideal world is the world we're in a couple of weeks. What do you think, Claire?
Yeah, I agree. I'm still getting to the bottom of this in terms of, obviously, the government lost a lot of time, energy, resources that would normally be dedicated to a budget in that last 8 weeks because they had very realistically had to split their attention, focus, energy on the Iran war and the fallout of that global oil crisis. So in terms of the changes that had come, the signposting of knowing there's going to need to be more work on, in terms of CGT, the startups issue, but even trusts, they've said pretty quickly that the legislation around that will not be going in this first tranche immediately in the coming weeks. So I think, you know, whether it was a lack of preparedness or a unexpected diversion onto focusing on the war, I think going into this, they did know that they were putting some broad structures in place that, as you say, would change. I don't think it was necessarily the case that they went big to give themselves room to negotiate back from, particularly because a lot of the direction that they are going in is one that the Greens, who are sort of the critical vote in the Senate here, already support anyway. So if anything, if you're thinking strategically about that, you'd almost go lower, knowing the Greens were going to push you bigger and further. So I do think it was done knowing whether it's, you know, because they hadn't quite got everything together yet or because there's obviously things that change as more stakeholders get exposed to a proposal and highlight sort of unintended consequences. But I don't feel that it was done in a way that was, we can afford to shave bits of this off. That's why we've gone a bit bigger.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. Our next question comes from Charlotte in Sydney and it's written, so I'll read it. Hi, Fran and PK. And I'm going to add Claire,
thank you.
Big fan of the podcast and especially your insights into how the sausage gets made. Yes, I do love a bit of a sausage talk. The media reporting on what to expect in the lead up to the budget turned out to be very close to the actual. It's almost like the media talked to people. No, I'm just editorialising too much. Let me get back to the question. While clearly a tactic of this government to soften the blow through teasers in the media, unlike the Abbott style of surprise, can you please provide some insights on how the speculation reported by the media in the lead up to the budget comes about? Is it journalists asking targeted questions and getting responses from media advisors that isn't no? Or does someone, and if so, who, a minister, a backbencher, a staffer, a government department employee, etc., talk you through what they will do, but with them withholding a few key details? Or do they email you a draft media release? I love the specific questions. Or do they text you a topic and you dig into it with questions? Well, my first answer, and then I'm throwing it to you, Claire, is all of the above in some ways, like a variation of all the things you said. I mean, a lot of phone calls, some of it they want you to know, and it's like they've briefed you on purpose. Some things you accidentally find out, and then you dig around a bit. Some are speculative based on previous things they've said. Yeah? Am I about right?
Yeah, I think so. I think with this budget in particular, there's been a lot of conversation about that this was very centrally, implication maybe that this was very centrally controlled by Jim Chalmers' office, you know, as treasurer, and they wanted to soften the ground. I don't necessarily think that Jim in any way was necessarily involved in quite a lot of what came out. We obviously had a bearing on the direction purely based from the sort of course set out of the, I don't even remember what we ended up calling it, but I think at one stage it was called a productivity roundtable and sort of late last year. That is where we started to hear about intergenerational inequality, that obviously housing was an issue. So we kind of knew the direction of travel for quite a while. What I found particularly unique about the lead up to this budget, this was my seventh federal budget, so I don't have a patch on you, PK, but I've seen a few, was I felt that some of the reporting of colleagues from the gallery, some of the very good reporting, really wasn't coming from the kind of executive part of government at all. There were some really good leaks this year, and I'd have to shout out Matthew Cranston at The Australian, who clearly has some very motivated person in, I believe, Treasury, for example. That's the question of, is it a department employee? So I'm posting some pretty technical stuff that is usually not what a government is trying to front run. When a government is trying to leak or hint or kind of give you a tip by omission, they're often looking to give you the principled reason of the why. And then comes a bit of prodding and poking and sometimes some verification or you wouldn't be wrong to report, blah, on specifics. But I thought this budget in particular, I think especially the tax offset, the Wado Wado, I don't know where we landed there, the $250, the fact that that was all rolled out before the budget date, that was definitely not endorsed by Jim Chalmers.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. That one was clearly, Jim Chalmers was actually saving that for the budget.
Yeah, that was supposed to be the birthday surprise.
Like, that was like, hello, we've got the Wado and we're going to build on it. And yeah, it coming out was not helpful for the government actually, and it telling the story, because it probably meant rather than surprise and more focus on that. On budget night, there was still a lot of scrutiny on just how much revenue they're bringing in from their wide-ranging tax changes on CTG and negative gearing and trusts. Let's not forget the trusts. Our next question is a rather high-energy question from Angus in Brisbane.
Party room. Bah, 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 bah. Angus coming at you from sunny Bris Vegas with a budget question. A lot of the opposition to the opposition's budget reply is, where are they going to get the money from for their tax cuts? Conversely, if Labor pushes through the budget as is, they're heading for quite a windfall. What's the word on the street about where that's headed? Are we thinking just reducing deficit? Is it going to be future tax cuts before the next election? Maybe investing in infrastructure? What's the skinny, you know? Anyway, keep it up. See you guys when you come up to Bris Vegas. Bye.
Angus, I love your question. What's the skinny is my favourite term, so thank you for bringing that to me again today. Anyone who brings me what's the skinny is one of my favourite people, so that would make you one of my favourite people now. Look, it's not even like I don't know anything secret here. I know something because it came out of their mouths, which is it is a tax cut. It is an absolute tax cut because they want to demonstrate, which I think, by the way, is really smart politics and even really good economics, by the way, that they will build in further tax reform and changes and tax cuts going into the next election that they'll promise as part of their big pitch. And they can do it because they're bringing in, if it stands up, because they might have to carve things out and change some things. But if it's in its current form, $77 billion over the next decade, right? That's a lot of cashola, my friends. Now, of course, you could take the cashola and pay down debt. Some people might think that's wonderful. Other people would say spend it on the poor. Other people would say other things. One thing that I think does really resonate is the idea that if you're going to change taxation and make people pay more tax for passive income, then workers working their guts out every day for their salaries should get more relief. So your passive income gets taxed more. That's the principle they tell us is around this budget. I think it's a very commendable principle, by the way, if it can be executed properly. That if you're working your guts out, you see more money than if your property is just old, just sits there, but it just makes you money just because you're lucky enough to have got it. So I think that's what they're going to do. Now, as we know, the Coalition has announced they want indexation. Basically, they want inflation rises with your tax scales so that you get more tax cuts, essentially, you know, because inflation goes up. So to change those arrangements, that costs a lot of money, but they don't have a lot of savings and they're not supporting the government savings. So I see a rather large hole in their agenda at the moment, don't you, Claire? I don't really see how you pay for that unless you tell us, and they're not really telling us.
Yeah, it's interesting. Both the budget and the budget reply have this weird delay embedded in their core policies that I think ends up hurting both. So to explain what I mean, the opposition announced the sugar hit, the $250,000 and growing that you'll get back on your tax from indexing the brackets. They don't take their medicine in terms of explaining how they're going to pay for it. So they've delayed that pain. Labor announce and front load, you know, in some people's view, the pain, the higher tax treatment of certain assets in different ways, and kind of delay the sugar hit. They put this $250 offset forward as a bit of a down payment and openly, as you say, announce that they are going to do future and grow more in terms of tax cuts. So for me, they followed something politically astute, which is to, you know, in their principled stance of readjusting the tax treatment of the income of a worker versus the earned income from an asset. But they have followed it with something politically stupid, which is we want to wait until we are in the eve of the 2028 election when it's front of mind for a lot of voters and we're going to say, scrap the $250, here's five or here's a grand. Yeah. That kind of means they've got to survive 2 years of pain to actually then get that payoff. So that's the first thing. The other thing that I think by not having that immediate payoff of those tax cuts announced, Labor is really struggling with this idea, this message that's everywhere. I see it all over social media at the moment, that people know wages aren't the only way to get to a house deposit, which is ostensibly the big solve that Labor were trying to go for in this budget. So they're turning to things like investments, they're turning to ETFs, they're turning to shares as a way of growing that nest egg and putting it into a house deposit potentially. Labor, in not being able to explain that that will never really be able to help you get into a house because the house market under the previous settings was moving so dramatically that you would never have been able to catch up, isn't then able to follow it up with the, and that's why we're giving you a really big tax cut to help you accumulate your wealth faster through your salary, and that will help you. So I think they've set themselves up for a much more complicated and convoluted conversation than they really needed to, purely from chasing that like political high of being able to announce fresh tax cuts in an election year.
Yeah, I think that is beautifully explained. All right, our next question comes from Troy, another written question. If the Prime Minister wants to get this legislation quickly through Parliament, will he consider a double dissolution and take it to the vote of the Australian people if he cannot pass it quickly in the form presented in the budget? Well, I'll give you my hot take on this. You'd never rule anything out, but I don't think that's his favoured strategy at the moment. His favoured strategy is to get it through with the support of the Greens in some form, and I suspect he's pretty good at negotiating, the Prime Minister, actually. You saw it with the EPBC, and there's been other examples. He and the current Greens, I think Larissa Waters, you know, she gets some criticism, but she's actually a shrewd negotiator, in my opinion, and also, you know, a real pragmatist, which a lot of people said that they wanted. Some people now have changed their minds, but I think she's been quite pragmatic. So she won't, I don't think she'll stand in the way too much of a lot of this. And then he hopes that the next couple of years you all move on, you calm down, the coalition continues to look messy and you re-elect him. That's what he hopes. I don't think he wants a double dissolution. Do you disagree?
I do not. And in fact, I'm going to go and make a really bold prediction here say that we may forever have passed ever having a double dissolution election ever again. Because that mechanism exists when a government feels that the Senate is not, you know, representative of the country, it's too combative, it's not allowing the government to deliver on its mandate. The last time we had a double dissolution election in 2016, we had this influx of micro parties, independents, One Nation really swept back into the parliament. If you think, if either major party thinks there is a chance in hell in the foreseeable future that having that threshold, that quota threshold, essentially lowered in a weird way by having a double dissolution election is going to result in a more friendly, major party-oriented Senate for them to pass their controversial legislation, then they are seriously misguided.
I'm going to say me too to that comment. Okay, next question comes from Tom. And I like the way it starts. Long-time listener, first-time writer in. I had a question related to the recent budget announcements. Why do politicians still communicate major announcements, especially things like budgets or economic policy involving numbers, in the same way they've done for decades and decades? Given how effective modern newsrooms are at using visuals, charts and on-screen graphics to explain complicated stories involving numbers, why haven't politicians adopted more of those techniques directly themselves? Seems like using clear visual communication would help them get their message across more effectively and reduce their reliance on how different media outlets choose to frame or interpret the information afterward. Thanks for the podcast. Really enjoy the show. I'm sure they're listening now thinking, yeah, we need to do more visuals because the question is a good one. There have been some changes, by the way. Like, you know, the budget doesn't – I've covered a lot of budgets, as Claire liked to sort of act like it was a compliment but wasn't. What is it called again? It's a drive-by. I'm being funny.
That's not what I meant.
No. They
you
do look
talk
a bit
about
different.
It all the time on the
podcast. No, I do. I'm very proud of it. I love a budget, love Canberra, love Parliament. It's like my home away from home. So many good things have happened there. So they do – budgets have already changed is my first point. There are more visuals in it, but your broader point is still correct. There's not enough of it, and I think there needs to be more of it, and they need to become more savvy, and they're not there. That's, yeah, I think you're right.
I love this question because I have been screaming it into the void for the last 10 days. You know, journalists like to fancy themselves experts, but really we're kind of like jack of all trades, master of none. We dabble in absolutely everything, but scratch the surface too deep, and we're probably deferring, as we should, to real experts in any of the areas that we're ever reporting on. And the amount of work that I have had to do in the last 10 days to discover things like testamentary discretionary trusts, or what it is to set up a bucket company to distribute assets in a way that avoids tax, has been enormous. And even at the end of all of that, when people like you and IPK are trying to explain it and put, you know, things into graphics, I can't help but think, I've been spending a lot of time doing the government's job. Mm. Like, in my attempts to explain this, I have been doing a lot of that heavy lifting. I think that the government is drowning at the moment in the amount that is required to explain. And I am not saying that everyone is out there wanting answers to all of these questions. Obviously, if you're directly affected, you are. Mm. But the absence of a ready-to-go cohesive campaign of graphs, of comparisons, of showing tax rates in this scenario versus that scenario is actually really shocking. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say the TikToks and the Instagram reels with Stitch incoming and smacking down tech bros for making memes, all of that is ridiculous and it is shooting the messenger. The government did not have a message ready to go for this complicated budget. And I totally agree. They have missed the moment by not having those kinds of visuals ready to go. Because to give two examples of not even misinformation, but just like slight misunderstanding that I see going rampant at the moment. One is I see in every Labor MP social media, people commenting that the 30%, and this is not me supporting the policy one way or the other, but just explaining it, that the 30% minimum tax threshold on CGT gains is, quote, only hurting lower income people who normally exist in a tax bracket that is below that 30%. Because Labor hasn't explained that what a lot of very wealthy people legally do at the moment is collect wealth through a very high salary that puts them in a very high tax bracket, wait until they have a zero or low income year that pushes them well below that 30%, and then sells their asset. And what that 30% minimum is actually designed to do is deal with that. Like, you can agree with that or not, but that is what it is designed to do. Most people don't have a visual on what that looks like. The other one is this message that Labor keep putting out saying that by changing the CGT, they are making it fairer and distort and removing the distortion that had people swinging into property investment. A lot of people look at it and go, well, if you're making the exact same change across every single asset type, then you haven't removed any incentive because you've just created a system where everyone is still treated the same. And if under that old system, housing was where people were going, they're going to still go there. There are complicated economic reasons to do with assets and their returns and the speed at which they make those returns that actually allow you to illustrate that that is not always the case. But like, they need graphs. They actually do need graphs. And it's really annoying me that people are getting yelled at. You know, I've been listening to a lot of talkback radio this week and people are just confused. Yeah, and the government is yelling at them saying, oh, well, political opponents and their allies are just coming after us. People are confused and they need graphs. Yep. So,
and they're saying, you know, talk to your accountant, look it up. I'm like, oh, my God. Okay, yes, I concur. I agree. Yes. Mark in Melbourne has written a question. Hi, PK and team. I'm a 36-year-old inner city voter in Melbourne. I grew up a staunch Liberal voter, and as did my wife. We both moved on from the party once Abbott, Dutton and Morrison came in. I've been desperate to want to come back. I've been waiting for something to like about the party, but I can't find anything. Then Taylor did his budget response. What was that? And indexation policy with no numbers and sounds impossible to fund, stripping benefits from taxpaying permanent residents and dividing Australia with one nation style politics. My view is Labor's tax reforms are like Dan Andrews during COVID. Public sentiment is that it's on the nose, so Liberals go hard. But actually, people respect the policy, leadership and change, and this will be reflected come voting time. My question is, why do the Liberals keep going so extreme right? Do they not see any path back through the moderates? Is my hope to find the Liberal Party I can like dead? Well, Mark, this is emotional. No. Mark, is your hope? Well, I'm not going to say it's dead, because I think to declare death too early is, you know, and then you find a pulse and then you're like, you've said something's dead, but it's actually still breathing and you're an idiot all of a sudden. So no, I'm not going to say it's dead. It is definitely on life support. Because the party is completely divided on a strategy forward. And I'm not saying this as my opinion. That seems to be confusing for people. I'm saying it because I've spoken to Liberals, really senior Liberals, who say that to me. Bridget McKenzie, she's a National, to be clear, but she's saying this week, I'll campaign with Hanson and anyone to defeat Labor in some seats. Okay, that sounds wild. Then you hear from others, you know, we need to distance ourselves from being one nation light. People like Andrew McLaughlin, who spoke to me at the beginning of the week, a Liberal moderate. They haven't settled this, right? But there are people who do like and want to build a kind of Liberal Party that you seem to be articulating to me, Mark. But I don't know if we're there yet. I don't know if the patient is quite dead yet either. What do you think, Claire?
I feel like we have spent this entire question time agreeing. I don't know if that makes for good
podcast. Let's have a Barney about
something. Because I know conflict is what sells. But yeah, I mean, I do agree. And like, for someone like Mark, I totally get like people's political identity and where they find alignment and feel that they can really have a faith in. Like that's really an important and beautiful thing to have in a, you know, open democracy. And it must be really challenging to be confronted with, you know, this shift that obviously has been really dramatic for the Liberal Party in the last, you know, last decade, but really the last 3 or 4 years. I'm not sure. I'm interested in this idea, this pathway back through the moderates. I think the answer there is in the question, which is there just aren't really any moderates left in the party. So even though those...
Not many.
Not enough that on any given debate, be it net zero, be it migration, these issues where there are obviously views that go further to the right than others, everyone gets up in the Liberal Party at the moment and has their say. Discussions ensue. And invariably, the person with the most votes in the room tends to get a version of their way, maybe with some caveats and some, you know, carve outs. But that, I think that's where the Liberal Party federally is at the moment, is where can they go in terms of a moderate direction if they don't have people in the party room. Having said that, I think you look at somewhere like Queensland, you look at what the Premier there, Crucifulli, has done, sort of pulling the LNP from the doldrums brink of sort of, you know, there was just this Labor powerhouse government that had all sorts of problems but was sort of always seen as the lesser evil as each election rolled around. Never say never, but I'm not sure that the makeup of the current parliament has enough people in the corner that you're sort of fighting for at the moment to deliver it from within.
Yeah, I think that's right. And your point is you obviously liked the concept of the indexation, and a lot of economists say it's good. What you, I'm reading between the lines, not even between the lines, but you didn't like that it wasn't costed, and fair enough. Like, you need to know how you're going to pay for things, right? I mean, that's, you know, that's a Liberal talking point for crying out loud.
Well, in the contest of who's, you know, the better economic manager, which tends to be one of the few things that's held up as a good judge of, you know, who's the natural party of government in this country, it's quite a departure for any party to announce such a big policy like that. And as I say, sort of delay the pain of explaining its cost pathway.
Mm. That's it for the party room today, but keep sending your questions in. We really loved answering them today. I mean, I'm speaking on behalf of you, Claire, but you looked happy.
This has been really fun, and it's nice getting like to touch grass and see what other people think about things.
Yeah, to touch grass. That's so good. Keep sending them to the party room at abc.net.au. Our colleague David Spears will be back for Insiders on Background on Saturday, speaking this week to Kate Cornick, CEO of the Tech Council, and then Politics Now on Monday.
Exactly, and remember to follow Politics Now on ABC Listen so you can never miss an episode. I was so fun filling in for Fran. I'm sure she'll be back next week.
Yes, but you'll also be back. You will be back. See you, Claire.
See you, PK.